You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
I'm a Bible teacher. I like to teach verse by verse Bible books. It's most of what I do. But back in the day, I studied math. I got an undergrad in math and a master's in math education. And I still remember sitting in one of my math classes where the professor was explaining the relationship between distance and velocity and acceleration, and how elegantly the mathematics that describe that phenomena fits together. And I was stunned. I raised my hand. I was like, hey, why is it that math takes this thing in nature and it's just so beautifully describes with a couple manipulations each one of these things? Why is that? And the prof was like, I don't know. And he just kept on teaching. And so ever since then, that just kind of stuck in my mind. Why is it that something abstract like math can describe so many things in nature so well? Fractals. This is a specific type of fractal. It's a mathematical pattern that the more you zoom in, you get the same level of detail all the way to infinity, the same thing zooming out. A guy named Mandelbrot discovered this particular fractal. And yeah, if you zoom in, like on this area, boom, you could just keep going down, and I'll show you a little bit about this. But yeah, what's crazy is this is a very abstract thing. You can describe it in a formula, but it's also in Romanesco broccoli and in the way lightning, filaments of lightning distribute in the environment, or river deltas seen from a satellite. You're just like, why do we keep seeing these patterns? These are fractal patterns occurring in nature, very similar to the fractals that you can study in mathematics. There's things like the Fibonacci sequence. This is a famous sequence where each term is the sum of the terms before it, right? So 5 is the sum of, or 3 is the sum of 2 and 1, and so on. And again, this appears in nature. If you look, you see pairs of Fibonacci numbers in the sequence will occur in nature. So 21 are the swirls curving to the left, 13 are the swirls curving to the right. And you see tons of examples, multiple Fibonacci numbers appearing in biology, even though this is something somebody came up with a long time ago. Here's what's even crazier about math. I can sit at my desk with pen and paper and these abstract symbols and infer that something in the universe must be there, even if I can't see it. And I'll show you some examples of that. And then the other crazy thing about math is it's beautiful. And it's not just, you know, because I'm into this topic, but talk to anybody in the field, and this is part of the vocabulary of both math and physics, this discussion of the elegance and beauty of the way we describe the world with math. It's a thing. It's beautiful to look at. This is what it looks like to go deep into a Mandelbrot fractal, and you can just keep going forever, right? And that's beautiful. But here's what, when mathematicians say it's beautiful, this is what they mean, is everything you see on that screen is described in that one simple formula. That is elegant. It's like, wow, all of that in that simple formula. So why is it? Why is math so incredibly effective at describing our natural world? This is Eugene Wigner, famous mathematician, and he was at a birthday party for mathematicians. A 70-year-old math guy was retiring, and the way these guys celebrate was they would get up and read papers. Okay, and so Wigner read this super long paper at the birthday party called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. And he basically gave detailed examples from history of how math, even though it's kind of anchored in our minds and it's a pen and paper thing, helps to describe nature in an uncannily effective way. And here was his admission. And this is not a guy who believes in God. He's just trying to be honest as he reflects on what math can do. He says, it's difficult to avoid the impression that a miracle confronts us here. Okay, so this is an eminent mathematician reflecting on a lifetime of study going, I don't know what else to call this but a miracle, even though he doesn't believe in miracles. And so I want to give you a few examples here of the power of math just going back in history. This is Edmund Halley. You know him because this comet was named after him. He was studying data of comets. They were fascinated back in the day with the flight of comets. He noticed this one particular comet had been studied throughout the centuries, and it had been assumed that it was three different comets that appeared over time. But by looking at Newton's equations, by using math and the observational data, he had this amazing aha moment. He was like, holy crap, the orbits of each of these comet sightings, if you line them up, they're nearly identical. And he was like, you know what? This isn't three comets. It is a single comet coming back over and over again. And then he took off his math hat and put on a prophet hat, and he made a prediction with math. Just, you know, paper and pencil, he said, this comet's going to return again in the year 1758. He never lived to see it. But it came, and he became famous. And it was a thing. He's just like, the math says it should be here. Same thing with Urban Le Verrier. I'm going to screw up a lot of these names. I don't know how to really say this. Okay, so he was really carefully studying the orbits of the visible planets. And he noticed that they were slightly perturbed. I think that's the word they use. They were just not quite consistent with Newtonian mechanics. They were acting as if a really large object was kind of tugging at them. And so Le Verrier called a buddy of his in Germany, another astronomer, astronomable, and he was like, hey, point your telescope here at this time. And the guy did and saw Neptune. Okay. Math first, discovery later. That's the example with all of these things. This mathematician, Carl, whoever, through math alone, theorized the existence of black holes. Of course, we've been able with, you know, you can't observe them directly, but you can see their influence now. We know they're there. We've studied this. The Big Bang, this guy never got any credit for it, not until recently. But he had all the math worked out, I think this is late 1800s, early 1900s, demanding that something like the Big Bang occurred. It was all in math and, you know, established pretty solidly in math before we saw, you know, the background radiation evidence. Same thing with antimatter. So, yeah, that's the pattern. Often math, not always. Sometimes, actually, physical discoveries help us understand math better, believe it. That's a whole nother topic. But often, it's math first, then discovery. This is why Wigner says it's unreasonably effective. Why is it that something so abstract in our minds in here works so well out there? James Jeans, famous British astronomer, his conclusion was the great Arctic architect seems to be a mathematician. I don't know what's going on, but I think there's a mathematician afoot here. That was his conclusion. Roger Penrose. That's a pretty big name in physics. You know, I'd say Stephen Hawking is the Michael Jordan of physics. Roger Penrose would be like the Scottie Pippen of physics. And his book, The Emperor's New Mind, is really an argument that it does seem like there's a mind behind what we're looking at. Here's what he says. There are things in mathematics for which the term discovery is indeed much more appropriate than invention. These are the cases where much more comes out of the structure, the mathematical structure, than is put into it in the first place. One may take the view that in such cases the mathematicians have stumbled upon, quote unquote, works of God. Now, he never comes out and says, I'm a theist. He does, though, keep coming, look up the word mind in this book on Kindle. And you just can't get away from the notion that there is a mind afoot, and that that's part of why what we're looking at is, you know, in the world is corresponding to the way we think. All right, so what are the explanations? Let's take a break here for a second. Let's take God totally off the table. You're not allowed to answer with God. What would your explanation be for why math works so well? What do you guys think?
It's a product of how our minds work and observe the world around us, I guess.
Okay. That is a view. Like, I'm just observing. I see two sheep here, two more there. That makes four sheep. Or I could see that this is not that. And I just kind of extrapolate and reason from that into this giant superstructure. It started with what I see, and so it works as it goes out. That's a view. What else? Any other thoughts? Yeah.
I guess the idea that if the math fits the universe because it's describing the way things actually are.
Okay.
So if the universe was any different, then the math would work differently because it's describing what's actually out there.
So yeah, really, I'm just looking at what I see, describing it, and so of course it corresponds to reality. That's what it's designed to do. Okay. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
I was going to say, we just discover it, and someone that's not God has created this for us to figure out.
Okay. Well, maybe the mind is another advanced civilization. And maybe they've kind of left an Easter egg in some DNA or deep down in one of these fractals. And we're going to be reading made in blah, blah, blah or something. Maybe that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We've been trying stuff, throwing stuff at the wall for years. Whenever something finally does work, we keep that and we just keep going with that. Yeah. Yes. Well, here are some of the views. This is Max Tegmark, and I'm going to quote him not describing his own view. He's a mathematician and a physicist at MIT. This is not his view. This is him just talking about his buddies in the field and what the predominant view of the mystery of math is. Here's what he says. Precision cosmology has revealed that simple mathematical laws govern our universe all the way back to its fiery origins. Most of my physics colleagues take them to mean that nature is for some reason described by mathematics, at least approximately, and they leave it at that. In other words, most people in the field are like, huh, and that's about it. I've heard the language, a happy coincidence. You hear that a lot. Now, this is Tegmark's view. He's got a different take. This is a pretty crazy view, but he's passionately promoting this. New theories in particle physics and cosmology have revealed mathematical order to a spectacular extent, from the microcosm of elementary particles to the macrocosm of the early universe. He's just like, math is just unbelievable. And he says, I know of no other compelling explanation for this trend than that the physical world really is completely mathematical. And if you're wondering, does he mean that we are math? Yes, he does. He says our reality isn't just described by math, it is mathematics. Okay, so now, again, he unlike Penrose, you hardly ever hear him talk about mind. He's stridently resistant to the idea that anybody made this. But he is very upfront about the fact that, yeah, it's like the whole thing is math. And that's where he leaves it. There is a view that math is a language that's evolved and extrapolated from our observations in nature. And then there's Elon Musk's view that we're living in the simulation of an advanced alien, or the simulation of an advanced alien civilization. And that is not some obscure view. There are a lot of people that think like we're in a soap bubble that's about to pop, that's been constructed by aliens with, you know, rules that we're discerning. Now, I don't have time to go in and interact with each of these specific views. You can keep them spinning in your head. I'm just going to plow through what I want to talk about, and you can maybe use what I cover to critique those views. But I want to keep moving into the biblical piece on this. Are there any indications in the Bible, like if I were to just read the Bible, would anything strike me as a Bible reader that math might be useful, that math might be out there, that math might be something that was in God's mind? Okay? And just in case, I left you a couple fill-in spaces here in your notes. What is the Bible's explanation for math? God, right? The mind of God. That's the explanation. And you could, it's interesting, you can go at this several different ways. Whoever wrote the Bible, we know people wrote it, but God inspired them. And so the Bible ultimately is a product of God. And God's accounting God, right? There's a whole book of numbers, right? For just to keep track of things. Counting people and things, that's in there. Keeping track of time. Measuring distance, area, and volume. Study the architectural plans for the temple at the end of Ezekiel. It's just a super elaborate thing. You can actually get online and see people that have built digital representations of that image. So yeah, the idea that I could use numbers to describe physical space, that's in the Bible. Here's a crazy thing. There are maybe 20 fundamental axioms of arithmetic. You could list them all, and I'm not going to get into the details, but you can go through the Bible and see verses that show knowledge of these axioms. For instance, this is the commutative law of addition. Okay, we're just a teeny bit of math. Here we go. Ready? Luke 12:52. From now on, five members in one household will be divided, three against two and two against three. There you go. That is the commutative law of addition. Now, I'm not going to go through all these. Check this out. Numbers, you can go home and read this. Read that passage and see if you can discern the distributive law of addition in that passage. It's in there. I left you a reference. If you don't believe me, read that. I gave you a reference. I forget the author's name. He's got a whole paper on this. It's pretty persuasive. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying the Bible was written to be a math textbook. I'm just saying that the person behind the Bible understands and can articulate mathematical concepts. Not just that, but also the God of the Bible is a God of order, right? Not just in what he prefers. Here he tells the church at Corinth, you should be doing things decently and in order. Not just that. But also the idea that God has ordered our natural environment and that it follows laws. Right? Jeremiah says, I, the Lord, make the following promise. I've made a covenant governing the coming of day and night, and I have established the fixed laws governing heaven and earth. You can read Psalm 8 that talks about the course of the sun following its path, the idea that it would have a circuit, that it's predictable, that that's the way the world is. That is the Judeo-Christian concept of God. That is why when you look at like different parts of the world in history, that is a big reason why science, the modern scientific method, arose out of Europe that had a Judeo-Christian worldview. This is Nicholas Copernicus, a famous astronomer. Look at just the way he perceives the world. Here's what he says. Celestial objects in the night sky are established in the finest order and directed by divine management. Okay, that was the assumption of these guys. I'm in a world created by an orderly God, therefore I can look into the world and find order. Contemplation of these objects and a certain familiarity with them stimulate man to the best and to admiration for the maker of everything. So yeah, just the idea that, you know, he's assuming God and then going out into the world with that assumption. This is Isaac Newton, who looks incredibly like Michael Bolton, who was a terrible singer that maybe some of your parents were into back in the day. Don't ever listen to Michael Bolton. He's terrible. I was really like struggling with how am I going to keep people's attention for 45 minutes on math. So I'm going to do this once in a while. It's whatever I can do. Okay. He says, this most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. This being governs all things. He calls him Lord God, universal ruler. Okay, so that Isaac Newton was, he wrote like a whole commentary on end times prophecy. He's totally into God. Even Albert Einstein, who was raised in a Jewish home but backed away from theism, has to reluctantly admit that science presupposes, science assumes the world that it's studying is orderly. He says, I have no better expression than the term religious for this trust in the rational character of reality and in its being accessible, at least to some extent, to human reason. He's like, the most incomprehensible thing, this is another Einstein quote, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. For Einstein, it's just, you know, he had to move out assuming in faith that this is true. All right, so, and I want to argue too, so there's no doubt our worldview is matching what we're observing really well. What we're going out and discovering, the more that science proceeds, is even more and more aligning with science and aligning with mathematics. But here's let's push this a little bit more. Beauty in math. It's not just that math works well, but it's beautiful. Let me get into this a little bit more. Here's Bertrand Russell. He's a 20th century atheist, very influential. Mathematics, he says, rightly viewed, possesses not only truth, but supreme beauty, a beauty cold and austere, like that of a sculpture. And I want to try to help just give you just a little taste of what he's talking about. You saw that formula for a fractal. This is a famous formula, e to the I pi plus 1 equals 0. It's called Euler's identity. And Euler, by the way, looks a lot like Paul Giamatti, I think. But anyhow, Euler, this is the dude mathematicians want to be. He's maybe the most respected mathematician that's ever existed. If you know a little bit about math, if you've ever used symbols like these are very common math symbols, Euler's the guy that came up with them. Okay, and so he has this identity which relates one kind of equations to, it's complicated, you don't need to know. It's a famous equation, it's a useful equation in geometry and complex numbers. But anyhow, let's talk about these symbols that are up here. You guys know pi, right? Pi is the ratio of the circumference over the diameter, and it equals this number that goes on forever. It goes on and on and on and on forever. And it's weird, you know, the Egyptians and the Greeks, even before the time of Christ, were aware of this ratio. They use this ratio. They were aware of how powerful it was in geometry. But what we found out since is it comes up in a lot of different unexpected places, like music theory or in actuarial science. Pi is an important number if you're trying to figure out how many 50-year-olds are going to die in Ohio next year. Well, pi will help you answer that question. E. Invented by Jacob Bernoulli. Bernoulli was doing some financial compound interest calculations, and without getting into the details, he noticed if you compound interest, not just once a year, but more than that, 4 times a year, 8 times a year, 16 times a year, continually over the course of a year, the amount of money you get out of doing that will tend towards a specific number. E He was like, why is this calculation moving? Like, it's called a limit, but it's moving toward this very specific number called E. Well, Euler, don't hyperventilate. It's okay. This is a intimidating math equation here. Okay, Euler, part of what made him famous is he figured out that E can be calculated with this infinite series. Now, it's really actually not that difficult. That's one. See, one is one. 1/1, that's one. 1 × 2 = 2, so that's what? That's a half, okay? And then 1/6 would be whatever. And if you do that forever, you get that number. You get E. That's what E is. Okay, so where did E come from? Calculating interest in a bank. What can you use E for? Probability, like if you go to Vegas and you're trying to figure out what's the best bet, E, crucial. Half-life of radioactive chemicals. Any kind of wave, like a wave in the air, a radio wave, an ocean wave, E is absolutely crucial for doing that. Okay, so here we got these two variables that were discovered in completely unrelated contexts with incredible power in the natural world. Here's another one. This is Girolamo Cardano. He was a doctor and an astrologer. He actually tried to come up with Jesus's horoscope. So this guy was a strange ranger, and he was into a lot of different things. But one thing he was into was solving polynomials. Okay, this is a polynomial. And I've tried to simplify this as much as I can, but okay, the question here is what multiplied by itself will give you 9? What squared gives you 9? And the answer is 3, 3 × 3. Okay, so if you're a math geek now, this is your chance to shine. What's the other answer? -3. You get 9, but look at this. Oh yeah, -3 × -3, that's also equal to 9. And so that's cool. You could do x squared equals 16 and figure all this cool stuff out. But what if x squared equals -1? Okay, now that's a problem because 1 × 1 gives me a positive answer. -1 × -1 gives me +1 because the negatives cancel out. You take any normal number on the number line, negative or positive, multiply it by itself and you'll get what? A positive number. Okay, so he's like, I don't know what that means. The answer to that, I don't know what that is. But he pressed on, and he took the square root of both sides, okay? So he took the square root of both sides. That's kind of like keeping the equation balanced. Gets x, and then he gets this weird, the square root of -1, which is like, and so he called it, eventually it came to be known as I, which stands for an imaginary number. Now, this is where people like undergraduate math students at OSU, this is where like I'm done with math. I don't want to hear about any imaginary numbers. Screw this. And this, by the way, you're not going to like walk down a path and go, oh, look, it's an imaginary number. This thing here, I, it's such an abstraction. It's not something that would help you like compete with other tribes on the early human in Africa trying to survive out there. Nothing that happened with us built us to evolve to like use this to survive. Okay, this is a pure abstraction. And yet electromagnetism, the way we understand the currents and magnets and how all that works, we can't do it. We can't do it without this special number. Quantum mechanics. Like, trying to describe what's really in the chair that you're sitting in, have to have I. Turns out to be absolutely instrumental for these completely unrelated aspects of nature that it was never even, this was about a polynomial. And so you got 1 and 0. They're kind of a big deal in math. All in this one beautiful equation, e⁶ + 1 = 0. That's a picture of beauty. That's why this one guy, this is a Stanford professor, he's like, he really reaches down into the depths of existence. Now, you read this and you're like, dude, you should probably step away from the chalkboard, you know. A little too much time rhapsodizing over these things. But here's the thing. Is it true? When you think about beauty, is it not just that it's beautiful, because it is. It really is amazing that those three completely unrelated, super important variables coming from completely different backgrounds all work together for that beautiful form. It is beautiful, but is it more than that? Is the scent of beauty a hint that we're on the right path as we describe the natural world? In other words, is elegance something that I should be thinking about as a physicist in order to describe what's out there? And the answer is yes. Let me give you an example. This is a Higgs boson. A Higgs is like a bubble chamber, and it shows what's happening when they collide these giant particles, or these teeny particles. This is Peter Higgs, still alive. He and his buddies were trying to figure out a problem. And the problem was, I wanted to throw this out too. I found a great article on this. You should check this out. This is in Smithsonian. It's called How the Higgs Boson Was Found. Look at the byline. Before the elusive particle could be discovered, it had to be imagined. That says a lot right there. And it wasn't just that it had to be imagined. Beauty was in the mix. Okay, so the question was, what is the mass of fundamental particles? That's what led them to the Higgs boson in the first place. They were thinking about quarks and electrons, and they had measured these teeny particles having mass. But when they did that, when they assigned mass to electrons and quarks and other these quantum particles, it ruined their mathematical equations. The harmony of their quantum equations was spoiled. This is how they would report what it was like. Here's the crazy thing. They were like, you know, what if we just assume no mass for electrons and no mass for quarks? When they did that, these equations, and again, this is the guy from the article, the Smithsonian, I think it's Brian Green, he says, they found a perfectly symmetric pattern in their quantum equations, like tips of a perfect snowflake. And guess what they did next? They didn't follow their observed data that, we have to have mass for these particles. They followed the beauty of the equations. This is how they describe it. Don't shove the particles' masses down the throat of the beautiful equations. Instead, keep the equations pristine and symmetric. And so they did. They kept their beautiful equations, and they theorized, here's what they theorized, what if the mass isn't in the particles? What if something in the environment gives those particles mass? Maybe there's something else, a Higgs field filled with bosons, or that ejects bosons, and maybe that's what gives these particles mass. That would make our beautiful equations work. And so that's what they concluded. There's got to be some substance that gives these particles mass. And based on that, they spent billions of dollars to try to find this thing that fit their equations. And they found it. They found a Higgs boson. And they found it by following the scent of beauty, not just, you know, by observation. Math came first. And not just math, but also a preference for beauty and simplicity. That's crazy. This is another guy here. This is John Polkinghorne, an eminent physicist from Great Britain. And I don't think this is a disputable quote here. He says, it is a technique of proven fruitfulness in fundamental physics to seek those theories whose expression is in terms of beautiful equations. Isn't that interesting? This guy went on to become an Anglican theologian because he was so struck by what he was reading. And I would guess that a lot of mathematicians and physicists are naturalists. I think that's probably true, maybe the majority. But in giving so much weight to beauty, aren't they doing something? Aren't they running the risk of being philosophically inconsistent? Why should there be beauty? And why should beauty even help us discover things? So, yeah, back to our original question. Where does math come from? Obviously, I'm arguing there's a mind behind it, as so many physicists are persuaded there is. And that mind is the mind of the biblical God. It says all things were created in heaven and earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. Jesus is the one who is directly attributed as creating the world in the New Testament. That's who's being discussed here. It was God, the Son, creator of the world. He's the one whose concepts about how things should run are being discovered in the world that we live in the form of math. John Lennox is great on a lot of topics, and he is outstanding on the biblical view of mathematics. He's got a couple YouTube interviews out there. I couldn't find an actual something out of a book on this, but I transcribed part of this interview. He says, one of the reasons I'm a Christian is because mathematics works. And atheism gives me no explanation of why mathematics works. The universe is a word-based universe. And he's so good with stuff like this. Universe is a word-based universe. How could you argue that? Well, we got this condensed abstract language called math that works to describe it. When we go and look in at biology at a super deep level, we see things like transcription and coding and interpretation, software. That's kind of what we see when we get down to the basic elements of life. He's right. The universe is a word-based universe. It's describable in a language, math, that resonates wonderfully with two things, two central statements in the biblical text. First, the very first words of the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Along with what he says in the same chapter in John 1, all things came to be through the Word. How fascinating is it that our Creator is described as a word speaker and that his spoken word is what brings everything into existence? Think about Genesis 1. You know, it talks about, in the simpler language of Genesis, it talks about God said, let there be, God said, let there be, God said, let there be, over and over again, injecting information into the world. And that word, that speech, coming from the mind of God is what we're uncovering when we describe math, when we use math to try to reason our way through our environment. Okay, one last story. And I want to use this story to just think about where would you be left if you just completely were unwilling to talk about God being behind this? What would you be left with? Well, this is Max Born. And this is Heisenberg. So these two physicists walk into a bar. I know it sounds like a joke, but they spent a lot of time just hanging out and talking about things. And this guy noticed that Heisenberg's quantum mechanic formulas, which were super cumbersome and complex, Born was like, hey, what you're doing there, that reminds me of matrix operations. Okay, this is a matrix right here. This had been discovered about 70 years prior, this way of solving complicated math problems. And so Heisenberg is like, okay, that's interesting. Born's like, I got a buddy who knows how to use these things. These old things are kind of like on the shelf in math. You know, they're sitting in the back room, they're on the shelf somewhere that need to be dusted off, but there is an expert in matrix operations, this guy named Jordan. He teams up with these guys to use matrix operations to calculate these quantum mechanical formulas. And it turns out, after they started to use this approach, it worked like really, really well. But it was just working for hydrogen atoms, which is what Heisenberg was into. That's what he spent most of his career studying. And so then, though, here was the, like, oh my God, I can't believe this. It worked for helium. I know, it's crazy. Stunning. I'm sure you're as stunned as I am. And it kept working for atom after atom. And so they realized, okay, we take this unrelated concept, we apply it to this really novel situation, and now we've got this model for quantum physics. We've just leapt forward in our understanding of how all this works at a subatomic level. It was one of the greatest achievements of the 20th century. And Wigner, at the birthday party, when he says this stuff's a miracle, that's what he's talking about. Examples like this. He specifically says we're getting something out of math that we never put in. There's no reason. It's unreasonable that it should be this powerful. Here's the very last sentences of his paper. This is where he lands. The miracle of the appropriateness of the language of math for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift that we neither understand or deserve. He says we should be grateful for this. You know, and the tragic thing is, he has that sense. We've been given something, but he doesn't know who to say thanks to. And I think that's pretty much where folks in this camp are left. There's just kind of an open spot. That's what Chesterton used to say, is that when an atheist sees something beautiful, the worst moment for him is not having someone to thank. And I think we have good reason outside of what we're talking about here to believe that it's our God that made this possible. He's the one we can thank. Okay, so what? Quickly, do you guys have a sense of wonder and curiosity about the world? Like the James Webb Telescope? Who here's heard about that? Dude, everything's about to change. We've got this incredibly powerful measuring device circling the sun to observe our universe. If that doesn't like grip you, that should. You know, man, holy cow, the things that we're going to be learning in the next couple decades, unbelievable. This is a biblical take, right? When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you've ordained, what is man that you take thought of it? This idea that we're contemplating and appreciating and God for what he's made, that we, you know, we get out with our families. And, you know, we go crashing through the woods or, you know, into a creek and we're turning over rocks trying to figure out what's under there. What is that weird shell? Where'd that come from? Just modeling in ourselves, having a passion. Like, I want to know. Because what is knowing? It is appreciating the God who made it all possible. It is a way we worship and appreciate him. Are you ready to have these conversations? You know, I would argue it's not unreasonably effective, that there's a reason why math is so effective. That's why I called it the reasonable effectiveness of mathematics. But I think that's a fascinating topic. What we've just covered, you could like drink beers with somebody. Not everybody, but there are some people you could talk to about this. There's topics on Rochford's website, like fine-tuning, just how miraculous it is that things are just right to support life, how unlikely it is that unlife could produce something as complex as a cell, even the simplest bacteria, or why is it that an impersonal world has given rise to consciousness? I think we walk around thinking, you know, nobody would really care about this stuff. Look at YouTube. Look at like Joe Rogan's podcasts. His interview with Roger Penrose on kind of what is ultimate existence, it's like millions of views. That guy is totally into that kind of thing. He's so popular, he's ported everything over to Spotify now because he's so in demand. And so there are people that want to talk about this, and I think an act of love for us would be to at least be able to just engage them on some of these topics. And so I'm really glad you were willing to spend this time on this. I know it's a crazy thing to do. but I think it's worth our time. We don't have to have all this figured out, but we can get into the conversation. So, well, hey, thanks for hanging in there. Let me pray for us, and then we'll get out of here. Father, boy, thanks for these guys' patience hanging in there with this topic. We don't have to learn differential equations to be an effective witness for you, that's for sure. But, you know, these kinds of things can help us help people far from you reconsider the possibility that you're there. And so I did, even this week, Lord, just give us some opportunities to put some of these ideas to work and help us never lose our sense of curiosity and appreciation for what an incredible world you've put us in, God. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.